Again, I'm going to remind you that you are joining today's RAF 101 broadcast, the Introduction to the Remedial Acquisition Framework. You are going to be joined by Kate Garufi from EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, where Kate will offer our EPA participants an introduction to the award and administration of the Remedial Acquisition Framework contracts. Kate, let me call up your materials and feel free to begin with the presentation whenever you are ready.
All right. Thanks, Jean. Welcome, everybody, to the RAF 101 webinar. I appreciate everybody that signed up for the webinar. I wanted to just give you all a disclaimer that there's a large training plan being developed for RPMs, project officers, and contracting officers specific to administering remedial work under the RAF structure. And the intro to RAF class is going to be a prereq. So your box shall be checked for prereq, so you will not have any issues signing up for any of the other classes. I have taught this class in about 7 of the 10 regions this fiscal year and fiscal year 2017. I spend a lot more time doing the class in the regions, about 6 or 7 hours, where I get a lot more in the weeds on a lot more of the project-specific planning as well as task order award type documentation and best management practices. I don't have enough time to do that today since I only have 2 hours, but I did want to sort of put a little note in for anyone that's going to be at NARPM. I will be teaching 2 classes that are specific to RAF in the context of acquisition planning as well as task order award. The first one is going to be specific to RIFS, task order planning and award. And then one's a 2-hour class. I think that's on Monday. And then there's one on, I think, Tuesday, or no, maybe it's Friday, which is remedial design, remedial action, task order planning and award, where I'm going to run some actual examples through a lot of the planning documents that I'm going to talk about in this class. So I really encourage folks to take that if you're interested in a lot more nitty-gritty real application of sort of the planning and award documents necessary to get contractors on board to do your work once RAF comes in place. So that being said, I'm going to start with the slide deck. You'll notice that I'm starting the slide deck on slide 10. The first 10 slides are sort of the impetus for change slides that I like to call it, so sort of why the acquisition strategy moving away from the remedial action contracts or RACs is sort of happening. I think I can really reiterate those on slide 10, so I'm going to skip over those slides in the interest of time. Feel free to take a look at them. They're available to you in the full PDF that we have. So the way that this class is going to run is I'm going to spend about 30 to 45 minutes going over the sort of some key drivers or some key things to note related to the change from RAF to RAF, what the remedial acquisition framework or RAF looks like, and then sort of how the acquisition tools specific to EPA are structured. Then I'll probably break for questions once or twice throughout that. The second half of the training is going to really talk more on the program and project planning level. So what do you as project managers or program staff need to know when you're planning and awarding task order contracts? And one of the things that I wanted to mention to folks, which I think will be loud and clear at the end of the 2 hours, is that the acquisition tools require a change in the way that we document and the lead time necessary to effectively plan and structure the tools to get the right tool and contractor on board. A lot of times project officers for most regions have been the program shepherds of acquisitions and have been the knowledgeable ones in acquisitions. RPMs are going to have to get more contract savvy. The tools are changing, and you're going to have to structure your tools for your project. So I'd like to keep that in mind as I begin. So this is one of the slides, what's changing, that I use a lot when I do briefings specific to the RAF, and it's a really good snapshot of what was and what will be. So I'm going to sort of talk through all of these rows and probably break for questions immediately right after this because it took a lot of information on it. So The current remedial contracts are full-service RAC contracts. And what do I mean by full-service contracts? What I mean is that for every RAC contract awarded, aside for AES contracts in Region 7, provide the capability for the remedial program to acquisition or access these tools to provide cradle-to-grave services, i.e., when using a contractor, you can perform everything from a fund lead perspective from RIFS, RD, RA, LTRA activities, as well as use them for technical assistance and, in some instances, if there's no conflict of interest, oversight. One of the big drivers or impetus for change was when the remedial acquisition contracts were put in place over 20 years ago, when we were switching from ARCs to RAC, there was a legal opinion that the RAC contracts could be structured in this way and were awarded consistent with the federal acquisition regulations if the contracts required the remedial action contractor, or excuse me, the RAC contractor, in the event that they performed the design, to subcontract out the construction. I.e., it met the intent of what we call the design bid build process. So what happened there, like many legal interpretations in the agency, is that legal interpretation was revisited by our acquisition office and headquarters office of acquisition management. And it was decided that although the legal opinion 20 years ago said that subcontracting out the remedial action met the intent of the federal acquisition regulations, at the end of the day, the designer and the remedial action contractor were essentially the same entity. Therefore, the way that these contracts were procured and that legal opinion didn't really meet the intent and the spirit of the federal acquisition regulations or FAR. So what we knew when we were in contracts 2010 and this whole legal discussion occurred was that we were going to have to move and pretty much more formally separate design and remedial action activities. So we were going to have to do a split at design, i.e. the designer would have to be different than the remedial action implementator. So designer bid out construction to a different entity performing the construction. The next line talks a little bit about how RAC contracts are currently structured. So most RAC, all the RAC contracts are what we call single award contracts. Generally, each region has at least one small business RAC and one large business RAC. And what I mean by single award is that when we go out to award a, let's say, a large business RAC, we put out one solicitation requesting proposals from the entire world, large businesses, small businesses, whoever wants to propose. We do the evaluation, and we select and award one contract. So the way that I explain that in layman's terms is one solicitation equals one award. So each region would go out with a large business solicitation and a small business solicitation with the intent of awarding one large business and one small business in each region. So what we're moving towards now in order to streamline or reduce the number of acquisitions is we are going to move towards multiple award contracts. In this situation, when the agency goes out with a request for proposals or wants to put a contract in place, they put one solicitation out, they get multiple, generally multiple offers in, and instead of making only one award, the agency under each solicitation makes multiple awards. So one solicitation and multiple awards under that solicitation. So again, at a very high level, what that does is it reduces the number of contract actions that need to be done by our acquisition arm of EPA. I'm trying to see. We've got a bunch of people from Region 3 on the phone. Five of the 10 regions, their RAC contracts are work assignment contracts. And what work assignment contracts do is they essentially allow the timing of money to be put on the contract, i.e. the obligation timing, and the flexibility of moving money between projects is much more streamlined. Work assignment contracts in the agency are being sunsetted, as I like to call it. So we are now moving towards all contracts being task order contracts. That means that each task order is essentially managed like a mini contract. So that means that the way that dollars are obligated, the timing, as well as the planning and moving money around requires much more planning and foresight and a lot more administration. Hey, Jean, I got kicked off of Adobe Connect, and I think I just got back on, so you might have to make my rights again. Anyways, sorry, I apologize. So related to the single award and multiple award contracts, as I said before, since we're moving away from single award contracts and moving towards multiple award contracts, since we are awarding multiple contracts under one solicitation, what that does in federal acquisition or FAR land is it requires the agency, every time they have a requirement that is going to be put on a multiple award contract and it is above the simplified acquisition threshold, which is really low, the agency must give every contract holder a fair opportunity to compete for the requirement, i.e., for most, I would say 95% of the remedial work that you guys are going to be doing under the RAF contract, instead of selecting a contractor, either your large or small business, you're going to have to go through a structured agency-defined fair opportunity process to select the contractor, which means, in essence, you, the program, no longer choose the contractor. You go through an acquisition approach and methodology defined by the agency, which considers technical and or cost and arrives at the best qualified contractor. That means that one needs to work with the contracting officer to plan that approach. And I'll get a lot more into what that means later in the presentation. So the reason that we had to go to multiple award contracts is at a government level, there is a push and has been a push for quite some time to maximize competition for government work. And if you think about the way RAC contracts are awarded, they're 10-year contracts, which means EPA only, quote unquote, formally competes work under RAC once every 10 years. Once those contractors have contracts, they essentially have a corner of the market, and the only decision that's made by the agency is whether to put a task order or work assignment on a large business versus a small business RAC. This, of course, now, instead of we're not only competing the contract at the contract level to award, to provide multiple awards to multiple vendors, we are also competing work amongst them for all of our requirements. So next is the consideration of small business. As I said before, most regions have the choice between a large and a small. Under the new acquisition strategy that EPA is putting in place, you, for every requirement that you, the program, have, you will have the opportunity to compete the work amongst a number of vendors, and under all of the contracts in which you will have access to, there will be multiple small businesses. So what we're doing here is we are increasing the pool of small businesses that are able to perform your remedial work. So we're getting more small businesses up to speed on Superfund work. Next is the slide of, or the row that talks about regional versus national. As I alluded to before, the RAC contracts are awarded and administered at the regional level. The multiple award contracts are getting rid of the regional acquisition approach, and all RAC contracts are now being awarded nationally. So the solicitations will be done, are being done at the national level, and the post-award and the contract administration will also be done at a national level. So the number of solicitations and the number of solicitations were reduced, therefore they're being done more from a centralized or national perspective. One of the big things for me from the technical side of the house that is the biggest change management piece for 9 of the 10 regions is that the beauty of the RAC contracts, as well as interagencies with the Corps of Engineers, is we purchase construction management services. So since the RAC contracts have to sub out the remedial action contract, the RAC contractor themselves procure, manage, and oversee the remediation contract or the RA subcontract. The Corps of Engineers, through an interagency agreement, provides EPA with similar services. So one of the benchmarks that I like to explain to folks is that if you have a $10 million price tag for a remedial action that's going to be done by the Corps of Engineers or a RAC contract, you're looking at $2 million of that $10 million, or 20%, being used by the RAC contractor or the Corps of Engineers to provide labor associated with remedial action contract planning, remedial action contract solicitation, competition, award, and administration. It also provides dollars for remedial action oversight or technical eyes and ears in the field to do oversight of remedial action projects, contract administration, health and safety, quality assurance, et cetera. The rest of that dollar, or the 80%, theoretically goes to the remedial action contractor. So in a situation at a very high level, when you're looking at decreased budgets, and I know this argument is a little counterintuitive for some folks, the way that we can put more money into the field to do more work from a remedial action perspective is to try to take a cut into that 20%, or take some of that remedial action management services that we used to outsource and bring it in-house. So what that means from a contracting officer perspective is contracting officers are now going to be administering remedial action contracts, which means that the vehicles and the elements of construction are going to be new and different to them because the agency doesn't do a lot of construction contracting. From the program side, that means that all of the contracting officer representative and the technical oversight requirements needed for a remedial action project are no longer going to be done by contractors, they're going to be brought in-house, which means that from a national perspective, when you're talking to regions, it requires management to think critically about how work is allocated, because RPM's time, if they're doing a remedial action project under the RAF suite, is going to be much more time intensive than when we outsource it under the RAC or the Corps of Engineers. One of the other things that's a big change that I'd like to point out is work is principally done under RAC contracts. RAC contracts are nice from a program perspective because the tools in the toolbox are very linear. And by linear, I mean if you're using a RAC contract, you have one tool. It's either a cost reimbursable tool or a time and materials tool. So every time you're doing an RIFS, an oversight project, or an RA, you are using the same type of acquisition vehicle, either a cost reimbursable task order or a time and materials task order. You don't have to make the decision on what type of task order vehicle with your CO. Under the remedial acquisition framework, the EPA awarded contracts are going to provide us the flexibility to select the type of tool in conjunction with our contracting officer that best suits our project needs. So depending on the type of contract that we're going to be talking about, you can have a fixed price type contract, a fixed price task order, a time and materials task order, a cost reimbursable task order, which means, again, understanding contracts for the purposes of structuring your task order to meet your project needs is going to be important from the program perspective. And moreover, it is a lot more planning when you have a lot of tools in the toolbox in terms of acquisition tools, but this really allows us to best structure our acquisitions to manage EPA's expertise, project uncertainty, et cetera, and really right-size the tool for the project needs. So it's going to require a lot more planning, but these tools do provide efficiencies and potential cost savings. All right. Anyone have any questions?
And Kate, this is just a quick reminder for those of you that are listening on the phone lines. If she asks for questions, you can come off of mute at any time. For those of you watching or listening electronically, you can type them in. I don't see any in the electronic window, and I don't hear anybody coming off of mute on the phone. So I think you can probably...
All right. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to explain to you guys what the remedial acquisition framework is. I'll probably spend the next 30 minutes on this. Feel free to type in any questions. I'm keeping an eye on the Q&A. This is going to be new for some folks, so any question you have, please just feel free to put it in, and I will do my best to answer it quickly. So this slide is the slide that we use to communicate what the Superfund remedial acquisition framework is. And what I want to point out to everybody before I get into the EPA acquisition tools is the Superfund remedial acquisition framework is a framework that outlines all of the acquisition tools that are available to the EPA Superfund remedial program when they need to execute work. That means that there are a portfolio of tools in the toolbox. It's not just EPA contracts that you can see on the right. It is also other tools such as interagency agreements with other federal agencies, such as the Army Corps of Engineers, as well as cooperative agreements. The three colored boxes on the left are the three new acquisition tools that are replacing RAC. But before I get to those, I also want to point out some of the existing EPA acquisition strategies that are still a tool in the toolbox moving towards RAC. I already mentioned interagency agreements and cooperative agreements. I also want to mention site-specific contracts. I know I see I have some folks on the phone from Region 7 who does site-specific contracting for all of their remedial action projects. There will be a multiple award contract available for their use, but if they want to use a site-specific procurement strategy, whether it's to get small business subcategories or some other preference, they still have the availability of that tool in the toolbox. Also, removal contracts were not consumed by the RAF. Those are the ERS contracts and the START contracts that are awarded at the regional level. Those are still being awarded and administered more at the regional level than nationally. So should any technical assistance requirements or some quick removal actions or time-critical actions be needed, those contracts are still available for the program. There is the regional oversight contracts. I'd like to put a little note in for those, are being, in the most part, discontinued and consumed by the RAF in one of the three suites that I'll talk about in subsequent slides. There is one contract, ROC contract called a UROC, that was awarded in Region 5 for a combination of PRP and federal facility oversight activities. I know a couple of regions put some projects on that when they were awarding it. That contract will remain, but all other ROC contracts, in essence, are not getting recompeted. They will be included under the requirements in the three boxes on the left. There are some other regions that have specialty contracts. There are two that I generally talk through. Region 7 and 8 have risk assessment contracts, and Region 9 is in the process right now of putting a RFS, RD, and oversight mining contract in place. Those contracts, if they're in procurement or proceeding, if they exist, are still going to be available. Regions generally for the mining contract put certain projects in that independent government estimate when it was being scoped, so those mining sites may still use the mining contract that is under solicitation activities at this point. So now let's get into what is replacing RAC. So there are three contracts that are replacing RAC, and the way they're set up from left to right sort of mirrors, if you look at the super remedial process as a linear program, where the requirements fall in for each bucket. So as you can see, there's no longer one contract, there's three, which means the RAC full service requirement was divided into three unique buckets, or what we like to call suites of contracts. The next couple of slides go really nitty gritty for you guys into what is in each contract, but I'll sort of mention what the three contracts are. The first one is the Design and Engineering Suite, or DES. The middle bucket is the Remediation Environmental Services, which is RES, and the contract suite on the right in the orange is the Environmental Services and Operations Suite. So what I'm going to do now is spend a lot of time talking about how the DES, RES, and ESO contract are structured and sort of how they're going to be available to you as a regional program staff in terms of getting your work done. So I'm going to move on to the next slide. So let's talk about the DES contract first. There is I'm going to talk about the acquisition approach first. This contract is fundamentally different in terms of how the solicitation and contract award is done, and that will play out into the second part of my presentation because it impacts and makes it fundamentally different how task orders are quote-unquote competed and how contractors are selected to perform their work. So these contracts are awarded under FAR, Federal Acquisition Regulation, Part 36-6, which is a qualification-based selection. If anybody on the phone has ever sat through a RAC contract evaluation board, the RAC contracts were awarded under Part 36-6, Now the only requirement is going to be DES that's awarded under that similar qualification-based selection. So why is that different? So a lot of times when you think about competing contracts, you generally think about asking a contractor for a technical and a cost proposal, and based on your procurement approach, considering both those when you award a contract. Architect and engineering services have a different solicitation approach that is outlined in FAR 36-6. And as it says on the slide, it's a qualification-based selection. So what does that mean? That means that EPA uses this FAR part to select contractors based on who is most technically qualified, which means that you have the capability through this acquisition approach to look at costs almost as a secondary consideration and make your preliminary contractor selection based solely on their technical capability. So the reason this FAR part exists is for agencies to acquire architect and engineering services, those type of services that do not lend themselves to lowest price in most instances, in the majority of the instances. So the beauty of an acquisition approach like this is that EPA is able to not consider costs and through the solicitation process, look at the technical qualifications of offerers and review and essentially rank offerers as from highly qualified to least highly qualified and allow that to inform to the contracting officer with whom you choose to select or with whom you want to award a contract or a task order. At that point, the contracting officer is responsible for solely asking for a cost proposal and then working to reach what we call a fair and reasonable price before a contractor task order is awarded. So technically selected cost has to be agreed upon through the negotiation process. So this contract, because it is the FAR part is required, is being used for architect and engineering services, the scope of the DES contract really mirrors those types of remedial activities that require that architect and engineering expertise. So the predominance of the work on this contract is going to be for remedial investigation feasibility studies and design work, which means in the RFS, generally an FS is an engineering evaluation of multiple alternatives and design is engineering a remedy. So that is where your engineering expertise is, and also it allows us to get some high-powered technical expertise in the form of risk assessors, et cetera, that may help in the RIFS process. As you know, not all our work is fund lead. We do have some responsible party oversight requirements where we use contractors. This contract may also be used to provide oversight support to the agency for reviewing technically complex PRP activities. So I would assume possibly using this contract for oversight would be complex design review, review of drawings and specifications, treatability studies, pilot studies, or really complex FS or risk assessment work. I also could see this contract from an oversight perspective being used for complicated negotiations and or expert witness testimony. This contract also has built into it the capability to do some brownfields work. Some regions have indicated that they do use the RAC contracts for brownfields, so we've built targeted brownfields assessments into this statement of work. But what we generally have in the DES is site investigation and characterization work, risk assessment, treatability studies, feasibility studies, design, some optimization, and brownfields. So this contract, like all the contracts under RAF, that EPA is awarding to replace RAC, is a multiple award contract with large and small business awards, which means that if you, remedial project manager, have a fund lead RIFS coming up, let's say in 2019, and you need to get that done and you choose to use the DES contract, you will have at your disposal the ability to compete that requirement amongst a group of large and small business award holders. Much like the RAC contracts, DES contract is a 10-year contract, which is structured as a 5-year base and a 5-year option. So as I said before, when competing work under DES, it's going to be fundamentally different than the other two contracts because of the way the contract was awarded. So from an RPM or PO perspective, the program's going to be going through a fair opportunity process, which will identify and document the rationale for why a offeror out of that pool that's available to you is quote-unquote most technically qualified to perform the requirement for your task order. Once a firm is identified and the contracting officer accepts that, then much like what you guys are used to now, the contractor is going to come in with a labor mix and associated cost proposal, and that's where the negotiation of fair and reasonable price happens. So what I'm trying to convey here is that these contractors are essentially selected based on technical qualifications at the contract level. At the task order level, a similar technically most qualified selection is what's going to drive who gets the task order award. I'm going to talk a lot about the fair opportunity process or the quote-unquote competition process in the second half of the presentation, but that's sort of one of the things that people need to understand is DES functions as a separate acquisition tool than the other two contracts that I'm going to talk about. So, as I alluded to before on the first slide of the presentation, one of the drivers for us in moving away from RAC to the remedial acquisition framework strategy for EPA contracts was the need to separate design and construction. So the DES contract is obviously bringing a fund lead project from RI through RD, and then the break happens where the next vehicle that is going to be the predominant remedial action implementation vehicle is the Remediation Environmental Services, or RES, contract. So this contract was scoped to focus on remedial action implementation. It's got four tasks in the contract level performance work statement. It has general requirements, field data collection and analysis, remedial action implementation, limited remedy operation. So if you build a pump and treat, you can operate it during the O&F shakedown period. And then it also has some design support. As folks may know, designs can either be performance-based or detailed. If your design is performance-based, then generally the remedial action contractor is going to come in with an innovative approach, which they will, in essence, design and construct. Therefore, they have to have the ability to leverage some sort of design expertise. So all that is in there. One of the other things that I wanted to mention, this is a question that I get frequently related to RES, is what kind of contractors are we getting under RES? The statement of work on the contract level, as you can imagine, for a national remedial action contract is very general. It pretty much says, prepare your work plans, implement remedial action, demob, close out, transition to another contractor. So one of the ways that we ensured that contractors that received an award under RES had what I call the full range of remedial services capability is we built into the solicitation the request for them to provide a portfolio of corporate expertise. Namely, they had to provide source treatment corporate experience, source containment corporate experience, in-situ remediation corporate experience, pump and treat build experience. So the contractors had to come in with teams that holistically could perform the full suite of remediation services, going from the service-dominated remedies, i.e. the ISCO biothermals, to the more construction-heavy yellow iron remedies, the big dig in halls, the landfill caps, the slurry walls, et cetera. So contractors had to develop or put together a team that was able to provide that full array of services. That's because we didn't want to get contractors that were just good at building pump and treat systems or contractors that were just good at doing in-situ technologies. We needed a ability to have a competitive environment for all the types of activities that we were doing. So RES and then ESO, which I'm going to talk about on the next slide, are procured in what I call your more traditional procurement approach under Federal Acquisition Part 15, which is a best value selection where technical and cost are considered. So on the contract level, the factors were technical, past performance, and cost price. Under a best value trade-off selection, which is how this contract was awarded, technical was considered more important than cost price, which on a very high level multiple award contract makes sense because you want people to be technically qualified. But the thing that's important to note here is when awarding this contract, cost or price is a consideration in contract award. that will drive how the task order competition happens when you're doing remedial action work under these. So it's fundamentally different than DES. So RES at a very high level is structured a lot like DES in the fact that if you have an RES requirement, say you want to build a pump and treat system, you will have access to a number of large and small business contractors to who you can compete your work. Much like the DES contract and the ESO will be the same, all three contracts are the 10-year contract with the 5-year base and the 5-year option. As I alluded to before, the fair opportunity or competition process for remedial action work will be a technical and cost competition among firms. So there is a technical and cost component to who is selected as the contractor. So it is not the most highly qualified. Cost must be considered. Last is the environmental services and operations contract. So I always call this one the garbage pail because it's like everything that we missed on the other two. But it's also sort of the majority of the work that's going to be done under ESO is two distinct work areas. The first one is remedy operation activities. And this is sort of twofold. Remedy operation is defined as any type of technology that may be subject to, in the fund lead world, LTRA or long-term response action. So really in the fund lead world, when I think about LTRAs, there's really three types of remedies. There's monitored natural attenuation, which just requires sampling. So if you're doing an M&A and you need someone to implement a sampling plan, the ESO contractor would be where you compete that. There's injections of amendments into the subsurface, in situ chemical oxidation or bioremediation. These contractors will have the capability to perform that for you. And then finally, the general pump and treat operation for 10 years. This contractor will provide the services to staff and operate as well as the materials for LTRA pump and treat operation. In addition to pump and treat and general remedy operation activities, this contract will be the go-to contract for oversight of potentially responsible parties, PRPs, federal agencies, states, and tribes. So this contract, I want to point out to folks on the phone, I said that DES did oversight of technically complex work. ESO is going to be the oversight contract where you do things that don't require that high-level technical expertise. That means that if you need to do split sampling, you need contractors to do some general oversight. Something that's really not super technical or complex in nature can be done under this contract. Federal agencies, oversight RPMs, the very, very restrictive conflict of interest requirements for contractors to provide oversight of federal facilities is in this contract. That means that the federal facility RPMs will have access to contractors under ESO that will not be conflicted out. DES is going to generally be the types of contractors that we see under RACs now, who most of them are conflicted out of providing oversight because they work for our federal partners. This contract will have contractors that are not conflicted out. So let's talk a little bit about why would you use ESO versus DES for oversight. DES is, when you're selecting contractors, is done on a quote-unquote technically most qualified. ESO is a technical and cost competition. So the idea here is under DES, you're getting the most technically qualified, but you're paying a premium. Under ESO, you can drive down cost price because projects are competed among multiple contractors where cost is a consideration. Therefore, per hour, you're probably going to get a cheaper rate for similar technical needs under ESO versus DES. One of the other things, as I call it the garbage can of like everything that we also miss, is ESO is also going to be that technical assistance type contract where there's a lot of like if you need well installation, you need someone to go out and do a round of sampling, you need a focused RI, you need 5-year reviews done, you want to do some remedy optimization activities, ESO also has that built in to the requirements. One of the other things that I wanted to mention is one of the critical changes that I mentioned related to RAF was that EPA is now taking on more of a construction management role when we're doing RA projects under RES. If anyone is familiar with the removal program, removal OSCs do on-site management of ERS contractors, But a lot of times, on-site construction management or response action management requires a lot of paperwork to be done. So the OSCs will sometimes use the START contractor to support them in their oversight, paperwork preparation, et cetera. ESO is a tool in the toolbox. It's not the only one that RPMs can use when they're putting together their RA management team to support them in the field when they're doing RA oversight work. So that contract's also available. So this one is unique in its structure because it's a multiple award contract like all the other ones, but it is set aside exclusively for small businesses, which means that when you have an ESO requirement, a non-complex oversight, technical assistance like optimization, or a remedy operation activity, you will be competing that activity exclusively among small businesses. And one of the things that I wanted to point out to you guys as to why I think this is wonderful in the small business world is, as everybody knows, there is a push to use small businesses whenever possible, and that is driven in part by the agency or the federal government's commitment to use small businesses, as well as that being reflected in small business utilization goals in the PARs of our managers and their managers. So, when I think about the, this is sort of how I think about this, is when we did the independent government estimates for 10 years for all three suites of contracts, you're looking at DES being about $1 billion, RES being about $1.5 billion, and ESO being about $750 million, which means that of that, we'll say, you know, $3 million 10-year requirement, almost a third of that is going to be competed among small businesses, which means a third of those dollars are going, being funneled by default and awarded on small businesses, which means that the hope, in my optimistic opinion, is that if we use the ESO contractor for oversight as well as remedy operation for which it was scoped, that it will take the pressure off us using small businesses for DES and RES work if the work lends itself to more of a full and open or consideration of a large business. So this slide just summarizes what contract can be used for what. I'm not going to really spend much time on it because I spent a lot of time talking about it on the subsequent slide. So let me talk a little bit about how these things are structured, because people are like, I don't understand how small businesses are going to provide a national requirement. The answer is they're not. So under contracts, in contract admin, there are these things called contract line item numbers, or CLINs. So what people can use CLINs for is certain pieces, components of work. They can use it for certain areas, certain geographic areas, et cetera. So it's a way to divide a requirement into different line item numbers for management of an acquisition. So let me talk a little bit about how this works. The RAF contracts are all structured with three CLINs or contract line item numbers, okay? These contract line item numbers reflect the full statement of work but are divided into geographic areas. So each contract has three CLINs. CLIN 1 responds to the full requirement. So let's take DES for example. CLIN 1 is the full DES requirement, but geographically specific to regions 1, 2, and 3. CLIN 2 is the full DES requirement with the geographic areas aligned with regions 4, 5, 6, and 7. And CLIN 3 is geographically 8, 9, and 10 for the full requirement. That means that contractors had a business decision to make when all three solicitations went out. So let's run this through the DES hypothetical. So when the DES solicitation went out, it's called a request for SF-330s. When the DES request for SF-330s went out, it notified contractors that they could put in a 330, which is essentially their technical proposal, for one CLIN, two CLINs, or all three CLINs. So if they wanted to be considered for a contract that covered all 10 regions, they had to put a separate 330 in for CLIN 1, a separate 330 in for CLIN 2, and a separate 330 in for CLIN 3. That means that the evaluation board had to look at all the SF-330s or proposals submitted for CLIN 1 and then reviewed and ranked them as their own separate ranking, and then did the same thing for CLIN 2 and the same thing for CLIN 3. And the reason that the CLIN concept came to be was because when we put out the source of salt request for information, when we were trying to figure out how these contracts were structured, we knew that small businesses, and this is more of a small business consideration, we knew that small businesses had the capability to perform the entire requirement for all three suites of contracts, but they were hindered by geographic coverage. So what this CLIN concept does is it provides more opportunity for small businesses to compete and be geographically responsive. So what does this mean in the whole award scheme of things? So let's take, what contractor do I want to say? So let's take EA. EA Engineering is a small business. EA may decide that they want to put in a 330 under DES for CLIN 1, CLIN 2, and CLIN 3. Let's say they only are selected as the most highly qualified for CLIN 1 and CLIN 3. Then they will get one award under DES, which will identify their award specific to CLIN 1 and CLIN 3. That means that their geographic coverage and where they are going to be, work's going to be competed, they're eligible in CLINs 1 and CLIN 3. Their contract max will also reflect the IGCE needs for those two CLINs. So even if a contractor gets an award or gets selected as the most highly qualified under DES for all three CLINs, they're going to have one contract with all three CLINs under it. Conversely, if a contractor only wants to be considered for CLIN 1 and gets an award, they will also have one contract. It will only say CLIN 1. So let me talk a little bit about how we differentiated contractors. So, or differentiated CLINs would be a better way to put it. So if you think about it, when you're looking at a DES statement of work on a national level, it pretty much says you must do work plans, do QAPs, and you need to be able to do RIFS, RD, treatability studies, and oversight. But because it's a national contract, it doesn't get super in the weeds. So when doing solicitations, Contract 101, you cannot give preference to incumbents. So the question was, how do we diversify the types of projects that we get for all three CLINs so that proposals are unique, not only in geography, but also in the types of projects and expertise that we see. And the way that we arrived at a consistent way to do that and apply it in each solicitation, which is specific to RES, ESO, and DES, is we put in site types and gave preference to experience or knowledge of those types of sites. So, for instance, CLIN 1 site types were groundwater with challenging geology, landfills, former manufacturing facilities, and sediment sites, which is regions 1, 2, and 3. CLIN 2, which is 4, 5, 6, and 7, we were looking at MGP creosote sites, groundwater with challenging geology, large geographic areas contaminated with chat, large surface water sediment sites, and something else, that, and residential high access sites. And then the West, or CLIN 3, we have hard rock mining, vapor intrusion, large diffuse plumes, or large diffuse groundwater plumes, and sediment sites, which just sort of allowed us to have projects that were tailored to the site type complexities that we see specific to those three CLINs. And that was sort of how we got some diversity from a corporate experience perspective on all three. So, let me see. So this is a picture of the DES, RES, and ESO CLINs, the geographic structure for CLINs 1, CLIN 2, and CLIN 3. I think I've beat this one down pretty good, so I'm going to move on. Now, the last thing that I want to mention, which I find to be the funky thing related to these contracts, which is going to play out for you guys in terms of task order, planning, competition, and award, is as if the change from RAC to RAF wasn't fundamental enough, one of the other things that was, brewing at the time that we were figuring out the acquisition strategy was this thing that came out that's called the Jobs Act, which further streamlined agencies' capabilities to do solicitations and awards. So what exactly is the Jobs Act? As I said before, generally when doing a solicitation, you need to either set it aside for small business or make an argument to do it full and open. So historically, for the RAC contracts, we've taken essentially the same requirement done one full and open solicitation to award it to a large business and set aside the other solicitation and did it exclusively among small businesses. So long story short, what the small biz or what the Jobs Act allowed us to do was under a multiple award contract, we could compete the entire requirement as a quote-unquote full and open competition, but indicate to the contractors and at the agency's discretion, reserve a number of awards for which we intended to small businesses, assuming they were qualified. So let's take the DES example. We targeted approximately 7 awards per CLIN for all 3 contracts. So under DES, if we got, say, 25 330s in for CLIN 1, our target was to make awards to approximately 7. Of those 7, we wanted to reserve 3 of the 7 awards to small businesses, assuming, big A, that they were highly qualified. So we weren't going to make awards to small businesses if they were not highly qualified. They had to be extremely qualified in order to get an award under a full and open. The RES contract was done under a similar strategy, and then ESO is a small business set aside, so all 7 awards are going to be small businesses. So if I am an RPM in Region 3 and I have a design that I'm going to be competing under DES, I have the ability to, I'm going to have approximately 4 larges and 3 smalls in which I can compete my work. Now, here's where it gets a little funky. So on the contract level, since it's full and open, the small business can come in with whatever type of teaming arrangement that they want. They can have a bunch of large business subs. They can have a bunch of small business subs. It's up to them, whatever makes them the most highly qualified to get a contract. When you compete work under DES and RES, the agency has the discretion to either compete it among all 7, approximately 7 contract holders within that CLIN, or they can reserve the task order exclusively for small businesses. So let's play the EA. Let's say EA gets an award under RES under CLIN 1, and I have to build a landfill cap. If I'm competing it under RES, I can compete it amongst all 7. Say there are 7 awards. EA can come in with whatever team they want to make themselves, you know, look the best in terms of whatever my procurement strategy is. I can also choose to streamline the number of contractors to which I get proposals from and exclusively set aside my competition for small business. What that does is it, instead of getting 7 proposals, I'm only getting 3. But how that changes the game for the small businesses is when you set aside a task order for small business competition, the small business must perform 51% of the work, which means that it cannot be a pass-through. So if you set it aside, you cannot go through a small to get to a large. The small must perform 51% of the work, which means in the EA example, if I competed my landfill cap construction full and open, EA may come in with a fundamentally different team than if I competed as a set-aside. So those are some of the other things that you may want to consider that complicate it further. So I'm going to take questions in a second. I see them coming in. So what this means for you guys is the one tool in the toolbox under RAC, either a cost reimbursable work assignment or task order, is now being replaced by your ability to use a myriad of task order types, i.e. fixed price, fixed rate, cost reimbursable in time and materials. The beautiful thing I like about RAF is that you guys can directly go to more contractors than you've had access to in the past. One of my examples is I know I've sat on a number of calls with Region 8 small business RAC contractor is PWT. And PWT has Tetra Tech as a sub. And Tetra Tech has good experience and expertise in things like modeling that PWT probably uses them for. So what we generally have to do if we want to access Tetra Tech on a scenario with PWT is we have to award a work assignment to PWT and essentially pay a PWT P3 or P4 to sit on the phone while we talk to Tetra Tech, because we cannot go directly to Tetra Tech because they are a subcontractor. Wouldn't it be nice if instead of having to go through PWT to get to Tetra Tech, you could theoretically go to Tetra Tech directly? So the nice thing is, in order to get certain contractors and having to go through limited primes, you're going to have more prime contractors through 3 suites at your disposal So the chance of being able to go directly to technical expertise is much higher. So for RES and ESO specifically, when we do task order competition, they're going against each other on a technical and cost competition, which theoretically means that more competition, more price or cost pressure should drive down cost price for us on these types of works under RES and ESO. DES less so because we are not competing it on cost, but I will say that DES competition will make contractors sharpen their pencil more, so I think we will get rid of some of that perceived complacency that we sometimes see with RAC contractors who are the only game in town for 10 years. And then last, which is my thing that I tell RPMs over and over and over again, is no contracts, because you have a lot of tools in the toolbox under RAF, and they can be your friend or your enemy. And if you don't understand contracts, you don't understand project risk, and you don't understand how to use your tools, you may put the wrong tool in place or you may get the wrong contractor. So there is the ability, if you understand your project risk, you understand how to incentivize and promote innovation, and you understand contract acquisition strategy, procurement approach, and contract type, you will get good products. So, question time. Hold on.
Okay, so, Kate, I know you're going to start browsing through some of those questions. I'll check to see if anybody on the phone lines has a burning question. So if you happen to be on the phones and you'd like to ask your question out loud, now's a great time to come off of mute.
All right, so two questions. ESO, there was a question specific to optimization. Optimization activities are scoped into ESO, which is a small business set aside, and DES, which is a full and open with reserves for small businesses. So a task order for optimization can be competed under either ESO or DES. I want to point out again that if the requirement in the independent estimate is above the simplified acquisition threshold, you cannot go directly to a contractor. You have to compete your work. Helen. So the question was, do you envision having both an RES contractor and an ESO contractor on your site at the same time, ESO doing oversight of the RES contractor, perhaps running a groundwater pump and treat to support the remedial action? Getting contractors to play together nicely can be challenging. So as the contracting agency, EPA will be responsible under a remedial action scenario of managing the RES contractor. Okay, which means you are responsible for contract administration, you're responsible for quality assurance in construction quality, you're responsible for health and safety. You, as the project manager, will have to start planning during the design how you are going to put together your RA team. That would be you, the RPM, and any internal or external resources needed to effectively check all the boxes to make sure that you provide appropriate surveillance, you're doing your QA, you have the appropriate documentation when you're going line by line to approve progress or lump sum payments, and any health and safety needs. The RA management team is not just the RPM. You may have an ESO contractor doing things like quality assurance, so following the three-step inspection process for construction quality control. You may have the Corps of Engineers helping you as a mentor and also doing that QA piece. With the ESO contract, with the pump and treat scenario that I brought up, the way that that would play out under the RAF contracts would be that you would compete a task order for the build and limited operation of a pump and treat system. So say EA gets the task order, they would construct the pump and treat, and they would staff operation of that. During probably the shakedown period, you, the project manager, are probably going to be preparing an acquisition strategy to get an ESO contractor on board to run it for the next up to 10 years, especially if it's a groundwater pump and treat system. If it's a containment remedy, it's going to the state, so you don't really have to care. You will probably overlap a little bit between RES and ESO in the context of contractor transition. So a lot of times when you bring an ESO contractor on board to operate a pump and treat system that was built by an RES contractor, you're going to need a little bit of training, so there should be some overlap there. I hope I answered that question. And I think, Helen, I think your question with getting multiple contractors to play nicely is going to be interesting. I agree. So with remedial design and remedial action, which, as many of you know, is like my thing that I think about frequently, I want to point out that the Corps of Engineers is still a remedial action implementation entity. There are projects that are so large or technically complex that we just don't have the bodies to do all of contract procurement and administration, or it may be in a location where we can't cost effectively put people out there. Likewise, there may be certain projects that are technically large and or complex in nature where an RPM will be managing an RES task order, a DES task order to retain the designer, an ESO task order to be doing oversight, and then maybe the Corps of Engineers to do something. There's a pendulum swinging point where you don't want an RPM just managing 9 task orders to do one project. So those are the types of arguments where it might make more sense or be in the best interest of the government to go to the Corps versus doing it in-house. But that's going to be done in Part B when I talk about project planning. So hopefully that was a long, convoluted answer. Will there be training for project risk management? Yes. I'm writing that training. It's in my training plan. We're actually doing a 4-hour class at NARPM called FunLead EPA RDRA Risk Management, where we talk about project risk and uncertainty. I teach it in my RDRA two-day class already. So take that class if you want. Otherwise, come to NARPM. We'll also have a 4-hour webinar on it, probably starting in the spring of next year. So the question was related to optimization. Can a DES contractor perform an optimization on another DES contractor? The answer is yes. They just have to make sure that they don't have any unnecessary or unmitigatable, which is not really a word, conflict of interest. Okay. Anyone on the phone? Jean, I'm gonna continue on my journey if no one else has any questions.
Just a quick time check. We've got about 55 minutes or so left until we hit 3 o'clock.
Okay, I'm about to transition. I'm gonna talk transition and then I'm gonna transition to planning. So what I wanted to talk about first is the current contract award dates, they're phased, DES first, ESO second, RES third. I'm not going to give you guys planned award dates. I just want you to know that the base contracts are to be awarded in the spring and summer. And DES is slated to go first, ESO is slated to go second, and RES is slated to go third. So, back to my slide on transition. So one of the things, my sister division in headquarters, the resource management division, Bob Jennings and Barbara McDonough, have been working feverishly to put together, they put together a transition plan that the regions and headquarters agreed to and are now working with the regions to get their transition plans together. So what exactly is transition? So the RAF contracts are going to be awarded in the spring and summer, which means upon award, EPA can begin the task order competition process, which means work is going to be put on some of them late fiscal year 18, some other ones probably not till fiscal year 19. So if we are replacing regional contracts with national contracts, there are going to be multiple regions competing work under one CLIN or under one group of contracts. So with transition, there is the consideration of looking at all the work on the RAC contracts, looking at all new requirements that are coming down the pipe, and working both regionally within the CLIN and nationally to prioritize how work will be put on the contracts upon award. So that talks a lot about, you know, on day one, if in CLIN 3, you know, maybe Region 8's contracts are expiring at the end of the fiscal year, there may be a priority, and this is just all theoretical, there may be a priority for all three regions to put new, you know, time-sensitive work on the contracts, and then for Region 8 to start transitioning all of their expiring work from RAC to RAF if it can't be done before the expiration date. When we talk about moving projects from RAC to RAF, the plan is the RAC contracts will have some period of performance that overlaps RAC award. The idea is that will allow regions to finish any requirement on the RAC contract that they can within that period of performance. And for those projects that need to move, for example, it's either going to be our oversight or RIFS. If you're 75% done with an RIFS, when's a good logical breaking point to take it off of RAC and then move it on to RAF with the hope, fingers crossed, that the contractor that was doing the first 75% of your RIFS is available under RAF to do the last 25%. So the transition plan is not only looking at who's got what expiring when on a CLIN-by-CLIN basis, but how that will impact the placement of new work as well as the phase transition of old work onto the new contracts with the idea of not extending RAC contracts any longer than they have to be. So if you are a project manager that is about to start an RIFS this fiscal year and the DES is going to be awarded this fiscal year and you don't have any pushing need, I would wait, because it's going to be an administrative barrier to get it on your RAC contract and then to move it over to RAC. That's all I have about transition. The other thing I wanted to mention related to everybody working feverishly is Resource Management Division in our office modified work planning over the last 3 years and SEMS for a number of reasons. Some of them are related to doing a three-year planning cycle, so an out-year budget and, you know, measures type need, but also working in SEMS to try to integrate some of the acquisition planning into SEMS, which is the acquisition planning in SEMS allows some marriage of the work planning discussion with the RAF transition plan. So they piloted that this year in work planning and talked a little bit about transition to make sure that regions were thinking about it and to start beginning that acquisition planning piece in the context of work planning. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that, not in too much detail. Does anyone have any questions on transition? I'm going to move on. All right. This must be crystal clear. No one ever asks any questions when I do webinars. Okay. If anyone has any questions, by the way, like 5 minutes after I finish the presentation, you can always email me and I'll be happy to answer them. I know it's like drinking out of a fire hose for some people that haven't taken this class yet. So just know that this is just a level setting and getting your brains thinking. There will be a lot more training to further overload you as the contracts come on board. So don't worry, or worry with some assurance. Okay, so there's two slides. In the context of time, I'm not going to talk a lot about roles and responsibilities. I'm only going to talk on the second slide, which is slide 25, which is people are like, if you guys are putting national contracts in place, who am I working with when I need a task order? So one of the things that I wanted to point out is these contracts, these multiple award contracts, are being awarded nationally, which means the solicitations went out, quote unquote, nationally, and the contract vehicle itself is going to be managed nationally. Okay? Much like, I like to think of these contracts, they're not like GSA contracts, but whenever anyone buys off the GSA schedule, you essentially take capacity off the GSA schedule and you sort of manage and award your own task order. The way that task orders are going to work under the RAF contracts is the regions are going to be awarding and administering task orders at the regional level. So if I'm a project manager in Region 7, We'll use seven for right now. Let's say I'm Liz, whose name is on here in Region 7. If Liz has an RIFS that she wants to compete, she'll be working with Don Denoshop, who's the RAM in Region 7, who will identify a contracting officer who will then go through the task order planning and award process with Liz. So although the contracts are managed nationally, and as I said before, task orders are like mini contracts, the task order planning, competition, and award will be done at the regional level. So for RPMs and project officers representing the program side, you will be interfacing with your local contract shop, unless you're Region 10 who doesn't have contract shop, then you'll be interfacing with Region 7. But the idea is the national administration will be done by a national entity, probably headquarters to start, but the task orders will be managed at the local level. So the contracting officer and the contracting officer's representative on the contract level will be responsible for tracking utilization, making sure things are done consistently, if people are trying to divert from any SOPs in terms of fair opportunity procedures or what plan they're competing their task order in, that would be elevated up to the contract level. So they'll be sending out probably utilization reports. They'll be sending out contract level reports that we get. They'll be collating CPARS type information. So a lot of that very high level contract admin, the task order stuff is going to be pushed out to the region. So one of the things that I also wanted to point out to you guys is if you look at this slide, which is slide 25, there is a contracting officer and a contracting officer representative. And then one of the big questions we get is, oh my God, where's the project officer? I'm a project officer, what do I do? Contracting officer representative is the entity or entities that performs representative duties for the CO, which may be administrative and technical in nature. There are things like invoice review and approval, being a contract board chair, providing technical direction to the contractor in the field, developing, supporting or the contractor in claims equitable adjustments, doing contract mods, et cetera. The contracting officer representative nomination form has a list of things that contracting officers do. Each region functions differently in how their RPMs versus their project officers divide and conquer work. Every task order will have a COR nomination form. That COR nomination form can be done by one human, or it can be done by two humans. So the region needs to decide from a contracting officer representative duties who's doing what activities the PO is doing and what activities the RPM is doing. If you have a project officer who is, say, an ex-RPM and is super technical, they may be able to provide some technical expertise to a RPM. So their dividing and conquering between the PO and RPM may be different than a PO that doesn't have as much technical expertise and may need to lean on the RPM more for that. So every task order has different technical and administrative requirements. Therefore, the roles and responsibilities between the RPM and the PO must be outlined and dictated on a COR nomination form for every task order. So no, POs are not going away. It's just that we, in a roles and responsibilities national guidance document, you cannot prescribe who does what. You decide in your region, because you are all different. Questions? All right, cool. So RAF program management, I'm going to spend a lot of time for you guys focusing more on ordering. So in program management, and by program management, I mean, how do things happen nationally in terms of what needs to be done when? The roles and responsibilities and the RAF planning, ordering, and administration process is outlined in the RAF manual. The RAF manual is a document that was developed by a group of headquarters and regional personnel. It is not finalized yet. I believe it is in the signature change, so it should be done probably within the month. That being said, I'm sure you will all probably see it. The beautiful thing about the RAF program, the RAF manual, is it provides a lot of forms and templates to use when the regional RPM, PO, and CO are going through site planning as well as task order planning. The slides in here talk about what I call two things, planning on the program level and then ordering and administration on the project level. So in the context of time, I am going to focus more on project planning and not talk a lot about program planning. What program planning is how acquisition planning is done between the regional program and acquisition office, and then work planning is the discussion that headquarters and the regions have every year related to planned project durations, dollar need, and acquisition vehicle. So the reason I'm going to skip over that is because there will be a two-hour training at NARPM on this type of planning activity that will get and give it a lot more due justice than I will in a small period of time. But since most people on the phone are RPMs, I really want to focus on, from an RPM perspective, what types of documentation and planning you're going to have to do. So I'm going to move on to that. Okay, so ordering. One of the things that I wanted to point out for you guys is, although it's in planning, the beginning thing that happens when you need contractor or extramural support to do work is you, the RPM, must fill out a form that is called the business case form. Okay? This is done at a site level for a requirement, or it's done, actually, it can be done for multiple sites, but it generally takes a requirement or group of requirements and provides technical and program rationale for selection of an acquisition tool. So, what is this for? This is to document for acquisition planning at the management level. If you have requirements coming down the pipe where you need to get contractors on board within the calendar year, you will fill out a business case that will be used to justify, am I using RAF contracts? Am I using a cooperative agreement? And not am I using what I like to use, RAF contracts, cooperative agreement, or interagency agreements. This document, I like this document personally because it provides the ability and flexibility for the region to make a business case as to why they need to go one way versus the other. As you guys know, when I talk RAF contracts versus Corps of Engineers, the biggest driver going one way or the other is a combination of technical complexity, site location, and the amount of bodies and expertise needed to effectively administer that technical acquisition tool. So this is the place where if you don't have the people or the expertise or the time to use a RAF contract and you want to go to the Corps of Engineers, you make that argument. This is vetted at a high level and gives you guys the go-ahead so you can begin planning how you're going to get these entities on board. I like this vehicle because if I were an RPM and knowing how much planning goes into using a RAF contract, and I'm going to say correctly, if I thought I was using an interagency agreement to do a remedial action contract, and somebody pulled the rug out from under me at the 23rd hour and told me I had to use RES, I cannot switch on a dime and be ready to award and manage an RES task order without ample planning, i.e. 1 year of heads up. So the RAF business case, although not set in stone, is a beautiful tool for everybody having a documented agreement on going one way or the other so you as the project manager can effectively put together your technical team and get your award for either your IA or your task order with your CO done in a timely fashion. One of the other things that I wanted to point out for business case is if you're going to do a task order or an interagency agreement, there should be a business case in your project file somewhere. Business cases can be used for multiple projects. And I'm going to give you guys two examples. So Region 8, Bonita Peak, Gold King Mine Site is doing a, as you can imagine, very large RIFS right now. They have one part of this 34 mine adit site that is being done by a responsible party. They are using the Corps of Engineers to do oversight for the, or to do the EPA fund lead RIFS, and they also are using the Corps of Engineers to do oversight of the PRP. Although technically they could probably do the PRP oversight themselves, it makes sense if the Corps is doing the RIFS piece that they also do the oversight so that the information being collected for the PRP piece comports from a data EDD, electronic deliverable perspective, as well as timing perspective. They all coordinate together. So instead of having to, the RPM having to make sure that their RAC contractor doing the oversight of the PRP comports with all the electronic deliverables, et cetera, the Corps is doing, it makes sense to do them both together. So if I was doing that under RAF and I wanted to use an IA for that, I would argue using the interagency agreement, and I would make it for both the PRP and the fund lead so that I could move forward with getting that entity on board to do both and making sure the nitty-gritty, like the electronic data deliverables, et cetera, are aligned. So it's less work for me to group them both together. Another example is RDRA. So remedial design and remedial action under RES is going to be fundamentally different than anything anyone has ever done before except Region 7, who does site-specific. So generally, one must design, get a designer on board, and execute a design in terms of schedule and cost estimate to comport with how you're going to do the acquisition for remedial action. So you need to know what your RA contract and acquisition approach is going to look like to best get the designer to give you what you need to support your solicitation package. So let's take the Corps of Engineers, for example. A lot of times it makes sense if the Corps is doing the RA and, say, the DES contractor is doing the RD, you're going to want to, if you have assurance that the Corps can do the IA, you're probably, or the RA, you're probably going to want to bring them in during the design to make sure that the designer is designing it in a methodology that the Corps can actually go out and procure for you. If you guys didn't get the okay to use the Corps, and you had the Corps design it for their acquisition vehicle, and then you were told you had to use RES, you may have to have the designer redesign it. So it's not cost effective. So from a forward-thinking planning perspective as an RPM, group together the types of activities that you think are best in the business case. And I know you guys can't see the document, and when I teach this class in the regions, I actually pull up examples so you can see it. But it asks questions related to amount of federal presence needed, timing of obligation, certain site features that may lend themselves to one entity or another. If anybody has used, we used to have this policy for documenting use of the Corps of Engineers, and there was this checklist for RAC versus Corps. The questions are very similar. That's why I refer to this document as justifying the Corps of Engineers. I think although some people find it insulting that the business case needs to be filled out because they already do this thought process anyways, I like the business case, once again, because it documents decisions and rationale for decisions and allows a project manager to plan and execute work effectively. It is going to be very disruptive if you guys get turned on a dime. So this is just a way for any acquisition approach issues to be brought up at the first hour as opposed to the 23rd hour. I am going to have a business case filled out in my RFS class and my RDRA class at NORPM that you guys can touch and look at, and a blank form, this form not in, you know, six font, will be available in the RAF manual. So this exact blank form is in the RAF manual. All right, I'm cranking. I have questions, maybe. Does anyone have any questions?
Kate, there were a couple of them in there in the Q&A window. Essentially, people were asking if you were going to have a checklist form available for this process.
Like the planet, well, I don't think there's, well, sort of. I love my vague answers. So the business case is step one. The task order initiation form is step two. And then completing the task order is step three. There's really only three steps. I think the business case is just which way are you going to go, EPA contracts or other. And then the next stuff that I'm going to talk about is all the things that you need to fill out before you complete a task order under an EPA contract. So this may answer the question. Okay.
Is the PO gone in this new model?
No. The PO, the roles and responsibilities are divided and conquered between the PO and the RPM contingent to represent the program and acquisitions. Every task order has a contracting officer representative nomination form. So every task order theoretically will have roles and responsibilities for both, and that should be outlined in that form and communicated to the contracting officer.
Okay, I think you can go.
Okay. All right, cool. All right, hold on, I gotta look at the next slide. Okay. So the next form, which to me is the most important form in the entire world under RAF and will require significant focus in terms of training, is the task order initiation form. Any task order that is awarded, any task order that will be executed under RAF must have a task order initiation form that is filled out to initiate the beginning of the procurement process from a CO perspective. So the task order initiation form, I know my lovely friends in Region 7 are quite familiar with the Advanced Procurement Plan, or the APP. The procurement plan, or APP, is really the nuts and bolts of what your acquisition is going to look like. What's the requirement? What type of contracts are going to be? All the nitty-gritty related to acquisitions, where technical fills it out, CO reviews it, the CO signs it, it goes into EAS and starts the process. APPs are very long and very information full, some of which you guys on the task order level don't really care about. So in order to document the critical decisions that impact the task order competition, award, and administration process, the APP for purposes of RAF is being, I guess, substituted with by this task order initiation form, with the idea of, again, documenting between the program and acquisitions what the critical pieces of the procurement approach look like, and is much more streamlined than an APP. So, Kirby, related to your question, the task order initiation form is essentially a checklist to make sure you have all your things done. So the task order initiation form in itself has a bunch of stuff that's super important in terms of acquisition planning, but also requires you guys to attach a number of things to it. First is a $0 PR, or a funding requisition. That's, generally if you're doing a task order competition, you're looking at anywhere from 2 to 6 months from start to finish. So obviously you probably won't have the money when you start, but in order to get something started in EAS, you have to have a PR, so you would do a $0 PR. EAS requires a milestone plan, an independent government cost estimate. If you guys notice the C is gone, it's now an independent government estimate. And then a work statement. So what are you buying? One of the things that I did not mention but will be the focus of life for people that do RDRA, ESO-type work specifically is the use of performance-based acquisitions to the extent practicable. The ESO and RES contracts are performance work statements on the contract level. They have the ability, based on the requirements, for you guys to either do a statement of work or use a performance-based acquisition approach using a statement of objectives or a performance work statement. That decision is going to be made when you're scoping your project and will inform whether or not you need things like the quality assurance surveillance plan. So if you're doing a performance-based acquisition, there are some other things that you need. There will be training on performance-based acquisitions, like Performance-Based Acquisition 101, that will be coming out for the program in terms of understanding performance-based acquisitions, how what the components are, what they do, what they don't do. One of the things also from an RPM training perspective, there's going to be a lot of classes on program-specific areas like RAFS, RDRA, LTRA, and oversight, where we will have large sections of that training on scoping, which will tell you guys how to write certain things. Like if you're doing an RDRA delivery strategy and you want to use a performance-based remedial action approach, how do you scope the design to effectuate performance-based acquisitions during RA? If you want to do a performance-based RA during an LTRA, how do you do that? What are some quality assurance surveillance plan, minimum acceptable quality levels, incentives, disincentives, all that stuff will be done later. So stay tuned. That's a whole other class. That's why I don't really get into it. Anyways, so what does task order initiation form have in it? The task order initiation form has so much information that will make or break the success of your procurement. So what does it have in it? First thing is task order type. So as you guys can see, there are many tools in the toolbox, depending on your contract, for you to select the type of task order that you want to use. So for DES, you can use fixed price, probably not going to happen on an RFS and RD, or more likely you'll be doing something on a cost reimbursable. ESO has the ability to go fixed price, which you could do for LTRAs, like a fixed yearly rate, fixed price for something like a five-year review or perhaps an optimization. And then there's also time and materials. I can see time and materials being something that you would use early in an LTRA or groundwater remedy operation where you don't have well-defined knowns in terms of materials cost, labor, et cetera, or you've got a lot of dynamic situations going on. And I also see time and materials in ESO being used a lot for oversight, especially as we all know with oversight, you're generally paying for labor. And the level of oversight needed, especially early in the process, is unknown. So time and materials may be more applicable for that. RES type work, which is remediation activities, can be either fixed price or cost reimbursement. The level of detail, or not the level of detail, the level of government oversight of cost reimbursable and time and materials is much different than fixed price. Likewise, the technical direction one gives is varied dependent on the statement of work and the contract type. So management of a fixed price from a contract admin perspective is fundamentally different than management of a cost reimbursable task order. Likewise, if one is doing a remedial action contract and you're going fixed price versus cost reimbursable, that understanding and how one scopes or phases it, whether you use options or phases, is going to have to be communicated to your RD contractor so they give you a schedule and a cost estimate that aligns with the way you're going to deliver it. So understanding your tool impacts the way you scope your acquisition strategy. One of the other things that we talk about in the task order initiation form is what is your acquisition strategy? So under DES, which I said is fundamentally different, and I'll talk about this, the acquisition strategy or the way you compete work is defined. The technical evaluation factors are in the FAR. Those are the factors you use in fair opportunity. RES and ESO are fundamentally different. In RES and ESO, those are best value selections where one can either use an acquisition approach, which is trade-off, where you say technical and cost are either equal in importance or technical is more important than cost or in some cases less important than cost, and you, the program, have to write technical evaluation factors for which you evaluate all contractors' proposals, and then the CO is responsible for the cost price analysis. They deal with any inquiries in conjunction with you. The technical and cost are done separately. So you must finish generally your technical evaluation before you even get any acknowledgement of what cost information comes in on a trade-off, best value trade-off. If it's lowest price technically acceptable, the way that technical evaluation criteria are written, are there minimum technical requirements? The CO gets the cost proposals. They send you the lowest price technical proposal. You evaluate it as an acceptable, unacceptable against the technical, and then the bidder, the lowest bidder that is technically acceptable for all technical evaluation factors gets the award. So the CO has the ultimate decision on whether you're going best value trade-off under RES and ESO or lowest price technically acceptable. You can have input on that and should have input on that because your project specific should inform whether you want to just see lowest price technically acceptable or you want to see all the technical approaches, and also will impact how you write your technical evaluation factors. So RPM, understand acquisitions, this piece is critical. Technical evaluation factors for RES and ESO projects must be project specific if you want to get the right technical people. You cannot walk down the hall, take the technical evaluation factors from your neighbor and use those. They must be tailored to your project to ensure you have the pen on technical. Make sure you clearly articulate what is most important to you. That is how you write the technical evaluation factors. Okay. So one of the other things that I wanted to mention, which I think in a dorky way is the cool thing about RAF, is who, I'm sure people have experienced under RAC what I call the bait and switch, where you'll be negotiating with a contractor and, you know, negotiating on expertise for a project manager, and they give you a project manager who's got, like, expertise in the type of project that you're doing, good, you know, you have a good working relationship with that person, et cetera. And then at the 20th, day two, they switch out the project manager and give you someone that's never done anything remotely close to what you're doing. Same with risk assessors or hydrogeologists. The way to mitigate that, which is how these contracts were structured, is the EPA acquisition guide has a local clause called the key personnel clause, which allows the agency to identify key personnel and define a minimum requirements and requires EPA to approve someone being switched out. Normally on RAC contracts, it's done at the contract level. So it's like the program manager, the quality manager, which you guys on a project level don't really deal with. That wasn't done on the contract level for RAF. That clause is applied at the task order level. So the program and the technical folks have the ability to define minimum requirements for key technical people, which means that if a project manager, if you're doing a radiologically contaminated soil dig and haul, and you need a project manager that has, you know, certain health and safety requirements and also experience doing large radiologically contaminated soil digs, you can put that as a key personnel requirement, evaluate key personnel against that requirement, make sure the person you get is qualified, and then also have the ability to approve the switch. So it mitigates, to an extent, the annoying bait and switch that happens under RAC. So just to point out, again, under task order fair opportunity, this is the acquisition approach, or the task order initiation form. We're talking, what is my dollar need? What does my phasing look like? Who is my COR? What is my contract type? What is my procurement strategy? What are my technical evaluation factors? All of that goes in the task order initiation form, which is the pretty much roadmap for how things are going to work. Anyone have questions? Oh, Liz has a question. Did you say disincentives? I did generally because I don't know how incentives or disincentives are going to work, but I was told that we would have a conversation about it. I personally, Liz, I know you guys use incentives related a lot in your RES contract to, like, past performance, CPARS ratings and stuff. I think there's a lot more opportunity under this to explore ways to incentivize or not incentivize contractors or disincentivize, if you will, that's above and beyond past performance, but that, you know, hasn't really been fleshed out yet. But we have 10 years to figure that out. Okay. So if no one has any questions, I am going to go on to how one competes task orders. I'm going to talk about fair opportunity generally, and then I'm going to talk about DES fair opportunity and then RES ESO, and then hopefully be done so you guys can ask some more questions. So I'll take about a minute if anyone wants questions, ask any questions so I can have a drink.
I hope that's a martini.
It's not, unfortunately.
Thanks, Kate. This is very, very informative in a scary sort of way.
Thanks, Kirby. All right, so I'm going to move on. I've got 17 minutes. Okay, so as I said before, all three suites of contracts, DES, RES, and ESO, are multiple award contracts, which triggers FAR Part 16, which is the fair opportunity procedures. So all multiple award contracts under FAR Part 16 for task orders under the simplified acquisition threshold must undergo an agency-defined fair opportunity process. As I alluded to earlier in the presentation, DES is a qualification-based or technically driven contractor selection. RES and ESO is best value, so it's technical and cost competition. So I'm going to talk a little bit about fair opportunity DES first, because it's different than RES and ESO, which I will talk about second. Competition of task orders will occur among the CLIN holders. So if I am in Region 7 and I have an RIFS, I will compete my task order among the CLIN 2 DES contract holders. There is, although there are three CLINs, technically there are multiple, so all those CLINs are under one contract, there is the ability to compete a task order among another CLIN's contractors, and that's what we're calling crossovers. That requires you guys to go up to headquarters for a contract level CO or higher, mother may I. So I would say compete amongst your CLIN. One of the situations that I can think about where we may have to do task order competition in a CLIN other than where the requirement is geographically located would be a situation related to conflict of interest. In some instances, you may have an oversight project where, for some reason, most of the contractors available are conflicted out. In that situation, if there's a contractor in another CLIN that can be available and not conflicted out, you could go in that situation. But again, status quo, compete within your CLIN. I would suggest not trying unless you have a darn good reason to compete outside your CLIN. The juice is not worth the squeeze. You'll have plenty of qualified people. So the question that people love is there any way that I don't have to compete work? And the answer is yes, but again, good luck. But I'll tell you what those exceptions to fair opportunity are. They're outlined in the Federal Acquisition Regulations. First one is urgency, which with all the planning that we're putting in place, I doubt there's going to be an urgent need to forego fair opportunities. Only one awardee is capable of providing the services. That, I don't think, will be a situation where if we compete requirements among multiple contractors that have Superfund experience, I'm fairly certain if they internally don't have it, someone on their team does. So I don't think only one awardee capable of providing the services would be an exemption to fair opportunity. Sole source based on economy or efficiency, a logical follow-on. That is the one that people like to think that they may be able to use to exempt themselves from fair opportunity. I personally don't necessarily think that people should consider using that very often. Again, not competing work goes all the way up to the competition advocate in headquarters for approval. So again, if you do not want to compete work, you better have a very good reason why. Since we are beginning the planning process for RAF in terms of business cases and task order initiation form, you guys can use these contracts to your advantage. Foresight and planning can allow you to scope a requirement with the sufficient ability to get a discrete piece of work done, like a whole RIFS, without having to recompete the RI and the FS. Okay? So think about scope when you're scoping for purposes of not having to do a million competitions on your project. Satisfying the minimum guarantee. One thing I forgot to mention on these contracts, let's take RES. If EA gets all three contracts on RES, they will have a minimum guarantee that will be awarded at the time of contract of $25,000 and a capacity of $1.5 billion. So their minimum guarantee is very low. I don't necessarily think that we would exempt ourselves from fair opportunity to satisfy the minimum guarantee. One way we might be able to do that is if we have a new requirement coming on, and instead of just throwing 25K on the contract, you may decide that you would like to forego fair opportunity and give a contractor a discrete piece of work. That may be an opportunity upon contract award, but once all the minimum requirements are met, this is probably not going to be a thing. And then statute expresses or expressly authorizes or requires a purchase from a specific source. That will not be a thing, most likely, under Superfund work, so that exemption doesn't really work. So really, there's no exemptions to fair opportunity that are going to be generally applied. There may be site-specific circumstances where you might want to explore them, but most work will be competed. One of the other things that I wanted to mention about the small business rule, I said before that we can set aside task orders for small business. One exemption to fair opportunity that you guys may see is when one sets aside a task order for fair opportunity among small business holders, you can choose to compete it exclusively among small businesses, or if you have a small business subcategory under your contract, so say for DES you have two small businesses and one small business that's the hub zone, the exemptions to fair opportunity do allow you, if the requirements lend themselves to such, that you could go directly to the hub zone without competing it. So if you have one small business subcategory under the contract, which I can't answer because none of them have been awarded, you can go directly to them. But if you just have general, quote-unquote, small businesses, it must be competed amongst them all. All right. DES fair opportunity. So I'm going to talk through the generals, and then I'll talk through the specifics. So DES fair opportunity, the steps are consistent with Federal Acquisition Regulations FAR 36-6A&E contracting and meet the spirit and intent of FAR 36 or FAR 16-505 fair opportunity. This is not a cost competition. When you guys think about competing a task order, your job as the program is to technically review, document, and justify who is the most technically qualified vendor to meet the requirements of your task order and your requirement, or meet the technical requirements of your project. Once you identify the most technically qualified, the CO then goes and negotiates fair and reasonable price, i.e., you agree on labor mix and approach. One of the things is, so you do your fair opportunity worksheet, or RIFS, or excuse me, DES has a fair opportunity worksheet. You justify and document who the most highly qualified is. I'll talk about that process on the next page. Once that happens, the CO negotiates fair and reasonable price with the top-ranked firm, i.e. the most highly qualified. If the contractor cannot agree with the contracting officer on fair and reasonable, then the contracting officer will then go to number two. I doubt that will ever happen, but it might. Contractors must be debriefed, and there's a potential for protests for orders over $10 million. So there will be the opportunity. You can offer unsuccessful vendors in the multiple award contract pool the opportunity for a debrief. As you can see here, under multiple award contracts, contractors may not protest officially to GAO unless the requirement is over $10 million. So if you have an RIFS that's $5 million and a contractor doesn't get the task order award, they can whine, but they cannot protest, which means that you'll have to deal with their whining, but you won't be held up through official protest mumbo-jumbo. So I would say the time that it will take you, the program, to initiate the task order fair opportunity process to getting the form done is going to be approximately 2 months. I think it may take a little bit longer when you start just because you guys aren't super familiar with the process. But it, once you get used to writing technical evaluations for DES work, it does become sort of methodical and will streamline in how fast you can get it done. So I think we will be able to streamline this fair opportunity process in terms of the agency or the program identifying who's most technically qualified for the requirement as we move through the process. And take it from experience, it is a technically challenging yet useful art to get good at writing evaluations of contractors to give them adjectival ratings. Okay, so as I said before, since each task order is essentially a mini contract, we have a COR NOM form that goes on the task order initiation form. And when you are ready as the program to begin the fair opportunity process for your technical requirement, under the DES contract, the region must set up an AEEB, or an Architect and Engineering Board, which is generally chaired by the RPM or the project officer. It can be limited to the RPM and the PO, or you may want to have certain people on the technical board for advisory support, such as a hydrogeologist, a risk assessor, depending on the type of requirement that you have for your RIFS or your RD. That AEB must identify a chairperson who is going to write the technical report. I will tell you, RPMs from experience, write the report. Do not have someone else write the report for you. It is a very technically challenging endeavor to argue why one contractor is more qualified than another qualified contractor to do your work. So it's a super technical, nitpicky argument that you will get good at, but don't think that someone is going to write it for you. You're probably going to have to write it yourself. So once you set up the AEB board, the CO charges you, you have a chairperson. You've already determined the competitive pool, i.e. you're going to compete it within your CLIN, whether you've decided to set it aside for small business or not, that's your call. At this point, you notify the firm that you have a requirement to which you're going to conduct fair opportunity. When you do fair opportunity under DES, we have the ability to do it one of two ways. We can do DES fair opportunity by evaluating information that exists within the agency currently. That would be past performance information as well as the 110-page standard form 330s that we got on the contract level that have things like project experience, key personnel, staff depth and breadth, office locations, and knowledge of the site type. You may, when you notify the firms, also ask them for additional information. So if I have an RIFS where I need a contractor who has knowledge of ARARs in New Jersey as well as experience doing high-resolution site characterization in fractured geology, I may ask them in no more than three pages, give me, you know, two project examples where you've used high-res for complex geologic media and how it was cost-effective, and number two, you know, give me two sites where you've done ARAR analysis in New Jersey. You don't have to do that, but I personally, after looking at 330s for quite some point, time in my life, would suggest doing that because they're essentially going to write your review for you. So for DES, when you conduct and document the technical evaluation, the cool thing about DES is that the factors are already written. Corporate experience, key personnel, past performance, capacity, and knowledge of locality. You, as the technical project manager, when you're filling out your task order initiation form for DES, have the ability to structure those evaluation factors in whatever order you want, and you can make them in descending order of importance, meaning that if corporate experience of doing high-resolution site characterization at a former manufacturing site in New Jersey is my key critical technical need, I can make corporate experience my most important factor. Therefore, the contractor that has the most relevant corporate experience doing site characterization in fractured geology in New Jersey may be the one that I can argue most technically qualified. So know what you need, know what you want, and structure your evaluation factors that way. So you're going to conduct the evaluation. You're going to give an adjectival rating for every contractor specific to each evaluation factor. Based on those adjectival ratings, you will rank 1 to 7 the firms. You will then hold discussions or Q&A is what I like to call it with the top-ranked firms, at least three. You can ask them clarifying questions. I would generally just keep it to that so that you don't have them give you a ton of information, because then everyone's going to be highly qualified. Then you compete your AEB report, ranking your firms. You tell the CEO who's number one, and then they move on. So as I said before, that is largely a technical justification using either additional information or asking for streamlined information from the contractor. That should be approximately 2 to 4 months. I'd say 4 months when we start, just because people are going to try to figure out what they're doing. But once we get into the swing of things, I'd say 2 months sounds about right for getting that whole form done. So for RES and ESO, as we said on the task order initiation form, you guys have figured out what your procurement strategy is with the CO. Is it best value trade-off? Is it lowest price technically acceptable? You figured out what your contracting, your contract task order it, or your task order type is, cost reimbursable, fixed price, time, and materials. The steps are consistent with 16505. You go out, you know, under RES, you either set it aside or you don't. You go out with a request for offer to all the contractors. They give you a technical and a cost proposal. The technical submittals are reviewed by the TEP, Technical Evaluation Panel, where the RPM is probably the chair in writing the report. The TEP report will be very different for lowest price technically acceptable than best value trade-off in terms of time intensity and length. You guys will do, the technical group will review the technical proposals. They'll write their technical report. The CO will be doing the cost price analysis. They can, of course, check in with you guys for any questions they may have, but the cost price proposals, the technical reports are two separate evaluations that together, based on the procurement approach, select the most qualified contractor. The amount of time that the RES and ESO fair opportunity process takes is a function of how much risk the CO sees on the procurement, meaning what's the dollar value, is there a potential for protest. The higher the dollar value, the more transparent and the more documented things need to be. So if you're doing a $20 million best value trade-off RES task order fair opportunity process, it's going to take a hot minute. It's probably going to take 6 months at least, start to finish, when we're starting, because you have to review technical proposals. You have to probably do a pre-bid site walk conference. You're going to have to answer Q&As with your COs. You're going to have to get the technical evaluation reports. You're going to have to review them. You're going to have to write the report. You're going to have the CO review it, approve it, and then the CO has to do their source selection document. So that was a mouthful. But I am just want to point out to you guys that this is a very high-level introduction. I will be going into much more detail on both of these fair opportunity procedures in two of the classes that I will be teaching at NARPM with some of your RPM counterparts. And in the interest of time, I wanted to open it up for any questions.
Again, remember, if you're on the phones, just come off and mute and interject.
Hi, Kate. This is Kirby.
Hey, Kirby.
How are you doing?
I'm fine.
I was hearing your last remark about TEPs. And the question is, the technical evaluation panels, they would only be for larger projects like RIFS and things like that. The smaller projects like optimization technical support and task orders that might be associated with an optimization at a particular site, 3 months, $30,000, those would not be subject to an evaluation panel, would they?
You would have to set up a TEP. It may just be you. Or it may be you and it would probably be you and the PO. So you don't have to set up like a five-person TEP. I think
that would put a lot of baggage on top of my work, I can tell you that.
Yeah, well, I just, because in a competitive environment under a task order, the CO must charge the TEP. So if it's just you and the PO, the CO has to formally go through the charging process, but you don't have to, the program decides exactly who needs to be on it. So you can literally, the PO can oversee you doing it, and you can write the TEP report. But like for optimization, you can always do a lowest price technically acceptable, just set the minimum technical requirements and like key personnel. And then it's more of a, you know, acceptable, unacceptable with some verbiage. So you would just see, they would come in with lowest price. They would come in with cost proposals. The CO would send you the lowest price one. Otherwise, you're technically having to review a technical approach for up to 7. So, you know, even if you're doing it yourself, it is time with the pen.
Well, I would just encourage the consideration of the need for how the technical evaluation panel might be negotiated for tiny projects. You know, if it's a $3 million RFS, I totally get it. But for a $30,000 optimization study, I'm like, really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the fair opportunity procedures have certain steps that have to be done. How streamlined all those steps are directly related to risk. And risk is generally related to dollar value. You know, so generally there's dollar thresholds for when you have to disclose your evaluation approach. For small dollar things like what you're talking about, you generally have a lot of flexibility, which inherently can streamline the process. So you have to check the box on all the steps. Just what you need to do to check the box varies greatly depending on the requirements. But the
I'm hearing you telling me that I need to build it. I will. I need to build it, and they will come. I get it. It's good. I'm good.
Yeah, we could sidebar on that a little bit if you want.
Yeah. No problem. Don't want to take any time.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye. I mean.
Yep. Yep.
Keep the game cool.
Yeah. Anyone else? Clear as mud. Cool. Gene, are we good?
Is anybody on here besides you and Kate?
Oh, no. There are lots of other people who are on and have been sending in comments and stuff.
Okay. All right. Let me get off.
No problem. Kate, did you want to walk through any final reminders, or should we go out through our closing instructions?
I would say for any managers on the phone, I would encourage you to encourage your fellow managers to take training on RAF, just to be knowledgeable on the change management. It's a lot more resource intensive for your RPMs, which may require you to rethink how projects are allocated and the types of training. Again, there's a large training plan that's in development that is for the program. Some of it's more PO-centric. I personally am working on a big RPM one that's going to be by program area. My hope is that you guys can prioritize just-in-time training for folks in your region that may be having to go through DES Fair Opportunity or write, you know, do an RDRA under RES. If you have to do an RDRA under RES, I'm here for you. That's all I think about. We'll be writing lots of guidance and training on the topic. That's all I got.
Okay, with that, I'll go ahead and walk through just a few final reminders. We did have just over 20 people who joined us for today's live broadcast from across EPA. I want to thank those of you who chimed in, as well as Kate, for taking time out of your days to help offer the RAF 101 webinar. As we noted earlier today, copies of the presentation content are available to download, as well as Kate's contact information. That's all on the seminar homepage. I included links to these resources on the Q&A window in the bottom right. You'll also find it on the middle right under related URLs. You can scroll through those links and then simply click a link to select it and press the Browse To button to open it up. One of the most common questions we get are if we offer participation certificates. If you follow the link to the online feedback form and fill out that feedback form, there's a box you can check at the bottom of it that certifies you were there for the entire broadcast. And as long as you check that box when you send in your feedback form, you will immediately have access to a certificate that you can either download or print out for your own records. If you participated in a group, each person can follow the link to that feedback form and then share their feedback to get their own certificate. So you don't have to register individually to get one. All you need to do is send your feedback in individually. As was noted earlier today, for